Thank you. I love being clapped before I've done anything. We're going to spend most of our time in this first session looking at some of the results of some research, as Simon just mentioned. The research is into the experience that complementarian women have had in working with complementarian pastors in complementarian churches. So that's what we're going to look at. Before we jump into it, let me I'll give you a bit of background about the study. But before I say that, let me just say, for some people in this room, this could be fairly painful, and for others it'll be challenging. Make sure you talk to someone if you need to, if things do come up for you. Depending on your experience, it could be quite hard. The background to the research, just so you know what you're getting, it was conducted as PhD research, and it was triggered by anecdotal evidence that men and women working together in ministry wasn't working very well. So I was, at the time, working full-time at Trinity Theological College training women for ministry, and that seemed pointless if when they got into ministry it didn't work. And so the research is designed to help it be better. The data was gathered using two methods. The bigger group was interviews, and those interviews represented 17 relationships between the participants, all women in ministry, and their senior pastors. And then there's a smaller group who kept some diaries day-to-day of their experience of the same thing. Now, if you're used to quantitative research, those numbers will sound really small to you. But it was a qualitative study using a thing called phenomenology, which you do not need to know anything about and never need to use that word ever again. But phenomenology has a close cousin called grounded theory. And in grounded theory, you interview until you reach saturation, and that's usually about 10 interviews. Phenomenology, because it's about experience, there's no such thing as saturation technically, but that is what I found. I'd stopped hearing anything new in terms of themes. So bizarrely, my 17 interviews was a lot for phenomenology. The main thing that we did in the interviews was talk about the whole relationship. So there were some context questions, tell me about your church, tell me about your job, and then the question was, tell me about your experience of working with Bob, whoever it is that they worked with. That was the only question. So what stands out in those interviews was what stands out over 2 years, 3 years, 7 years. That's going to be memorable things rather than mundane things. And so the point of the diaries was if it was a day-to-day record, just to see what came up in the mundane stuff. But the two pointed in the same direction. The interviews and the diaries basically had the same themes. And so that was a reasonable test of that. The other thing I want to say before we jump in is just to talk about anonymity, which was really important in this study. We're a pretty small group, aren't we? I suspect if I told you three things about a woman in ministry in Sydney, most of you would be able to tell me who it was. Certainly in Perth that's true, because there's not that many of us. And so one of the reasons for this study is that at a conference like this, it's hard to talk about negative experiences. Because as soon as someone's talking, we all know exactly who the players are, and we don't want to be involved in gossip or slander or anything like that. And so what the study does is take women from five different capital cities and make the data anonymous so that we can talk about it. So that was part of the point of the study. In an ideal world, I would have interviewed the senior pastors as well, but it's hard for each of them not to recognise the other one's contributions if they know that they're in each other in the study. And so I couldn't do both, and so I just interviewed the women. This is my first plug. Somebody needs to interview the men. There's a PhD in it if you need a PhD, but it doesn't have to be a PhD. Someone does need to do the other half of this research, and I'm serious about that. If that's you, come and see me. Let me urge you, though, to try and resist the urge to identify people as we go through. You might think, I know exactly that scenario. None of the stories I'm going to tell you, though, were true of only one person, and that's one person in the study. So if we extrapolate that out, you almost certainly don't know who I'm talking about. Last couple of things. It's not a statistically valid survey, just because of the way that the data, the sample was gathered, so you can't produce numbers from it. You're going to see some numbers on the screen that look a bit like this. P2, that's participant two. P3A is someone who worked for two different senior pastors. A is the first one, B is the second one. P3AB is that person talking about both the senior pastors. D5, anyone want to guess? Diary 5, right, there, cunning code. Okay, Now, how all this is relevant to you is going to depend a little bit on whether your staff team is like the people that I interviewed. So let me tell you a little bit about them. They're theologically complementarian by conviction. They were conservative evangelicals in the Reformed tradition. All but one of them had a three-year degree, at least, in theology or divinity. All but one held an undergraduate degree in some other discipline. Most of them were in their 30s or 40s. All but one were single when they started in their position, although some of them had married since then. And only one had kids during the period under review. In terms of their roles, nine of them were women's workers, four were children's workers, and nine you'd just call associate pastors doing something else. So sometimes that's an M, someone in the M's. If I talk about the five M's, do we know what I'm talking about? That portfolio model of ministry? Excellent. So that might be someone in an M or just someone with a range of other duties that you wouldn't call kids or women's ministry. All right, let's get to the main thing. This is the diagram that we're going to be unpacking, and if you've found access to the notes, then you've seen that you'll have that diagram. I'm a lecturer. If I was going to set an exam at the end of this afternoon, it would be one question: explain this diagram. That's what we're trying to do this afternoon. If at the end of this you can explain that diagram to someone else, then you've basically got it. You'll see at the top there, the big thing is partnership, right? That's the crux of it. Relationships between women and the senior ministers for whom they work well when there is real gospel partnership, and they don't work well when there is not gospel partnership. So it's not massively complicated. Where I want to show you stuff in the words of the participants. So let me read one of them now, which I think they might not. Yes, great. By the time Tom left, I knew that he really valued me as a partner in ministry. By a partner in ministry, I think I just meant he saw us and the rest of the staff team as those who partner with him in a ministry. He wasn't just our boss, we were colleagues. You know, there was obviously an order and a hierarchy. He was our boss, the buck stopped with him. He also saw himself as wanting to invest in us relationally and to do this together. There was a real sense in which we're all in this together. Yes, we have our individual silos and areas of responsibility, and there needs to be independence in those. We don't all be in each other's business all the time, but none of us are doing this as one people teams. We're all working together. I think that's what I meant by a partner in ministry. So there's a couple of things to notice there. The first is she's clear that partnership doesn't mean there's no hierarchy, right? Partnership doesn't mean equality. There's still a hierarchy, but there's this real sense of working together. It also doesn't mean that there's no independent work. So there's still your silo that you're mostly working. You're not doing everything together all day, but there is a sense that you're going somewhere together, you're in it together, you're doing it together. Let me give you another quote. So the context here is I've just asked this participant, give me a concrete example of something that made this relationship good. And this is what she says. I think thinking long and hard about my role at Bible study. So am I just there as a side, like as the token female, or are we actually partners? I think we started off as partners, so I would be involved in the study prep and things like that, so where things were going. So you can see there that sense of partnership. She doesn't want to be token. I won't get a show of hands, but if you've been a woman in ministry for any period of time, you'll have been asked to be on a committee of some kind. And the question you have in your mind is, am I the token woman on this committee, or do we actually want me to do something? Women don't want to be tokens in the ministry. They want a real sense of partnership where they're contributing something. So that's the big idea. And you'll see under the diagram there, under partnership, there's three more building blocks. If you've got these three things working, that equates to having partnership. If you do each of these three things well, you'll end up with a good sense of partnership. And the first one there is valuable contribution. So the woman in ministry is able to make a valuable contribution. It breaks down into two parts. You can see them there. So what that table is doing is just showing you how many times it popped up. So it's popped up in all of those participants. Two parts to it, a substantial contribution and a valued contribution. And the senior pastor is really critical in both of those. So the senior pastor defines roles and he allocates work. And so your ability to make a substantial contribution to some extent depends on the senior pastor. But also, to some extent, senior pastors define what's valuable. So what the senior pastor values is considered valuable by the rest of the team and by the church. And so your ability to make a valued contribution also depends on the senior pastor. There's going to be a lot today about the senior pastor. That's the nature of the research. Let's take each of them in turn. So a substantial contribution, we just read a quote, the participant doesn't want to be token. Right? She wants to do something real. Here's a longer quote. Yep. While I was working with Senior Pastor A, there wasn't kind of time to step away and something I couldn't understand. What could we do better there? Or how can I contribute theologically to the sermon series? Or so kind of feeling like a worker rather than like a pastor with things to contribute theologically. Yeah, like a really, really competent apprentice. Now, there's more than one way to make a substantial contribution, but you can hear the idea. She's not an apprentice, and she wants to get stuck into something that's substantial. Now, everyone in ministry has to do irritating things, right? We all have to do admin. We all have to do odd jobs. That's just part of ministry. But you need something you can sink your teeth into. And that links as well with being given some freedom in the tasks that you've been given. Women commented really positively on being given freedom in their areas of responsibility and really negatively about being micromanaged, which is the opposite of being given freedom. So why is that? I think first, when you have freedom, that is when you can make a substantial contribution, right? You're not substituting for a trained monkey or a robot. Like, you're able to make a really substantial contribution because you've got a little bit of freedom. But secondly, freedom demonstrates trust. And part of a healthy relationship with the senior pastor is that trust, which comes out by being given freedom. So let me give you several quotes for this just to nail the idea. Participant two, this is the senior pastor, totally trusted me. Not a micromanager in any way. He's like, just go for it. See the opposite there? Trust and micromanaging, two opposite things. Participant three, what else does he do well? Well, he just lets you get on with it, I think. Like, he's given me a very long lead or leash or whatever you want to say, and I think that's worked quite well. Participant seven, I felt my input has been valued. Particularly with children's ministry, I was given a lot of authority or scope to make decisions and then just run. So trust was a big thing. Again, freedom and trust. And participant eight, other things that make working with him good, I think I've been given a fair amount of freedom and autonomy in what I'm doing. And I feel like he generally backs me on things and is happy for me to make decisions and calls and, like, trust me with areas of responsibility. Put all that together, the gist of it is, give me a real job and let me do it. When you do that, that's going to build trust and that's going to build the relationship. I hope none of that is startling, right? It's fairly obvious, but it's an important thing. Women want to make a substantial contribution. The other part is making a valued contribution. And particularly, that came out in whether or not the senior pastor valued the contribution being made. That might make you a little bit nervous. Sort of hope it makes you a little bit nervous. Because we want to serve God, don't we, primarily? And if God values our ministry, what do I care what other people think? And I would say I don't think the women did undervalue their ministries even when the senior pastors did, but it doesn't help the relationship. So here are quotations from two children's workers. This is the easiest test of the day. One of these ended in resignation. See if you can pick it. Participant seven. Some people have to battle their senior pastors to get budget or to approve something or to take children's ministry seriously by coming to a conference or... Like Simon, when I did Kids Club, he and his wife did tea and coffee at the start for parents as they dropped kids off as a way of connecting to the parents. Like, how many senior pastors would do that and their wives would do that? So it's all little things like that that add up to we support you and we show you that support in a way that other people can see that we support you and support this ministry. That's participant seven. Here's participant 12. Children's ministry was at the bottom, like you were constantly trying to recruit leaders. Well, that's your job, Anne, just go ahead and do it. There was no encouragement of it. There was no upfront encouragement or support of children's ministry. There was no value in what I did. There was no acknowledgement of value in even the training of leaders. It was just this constant battle of acknowledging if children or what I did was of any value. I assume we could all pick it. It's the second one that ended in resignation. Talking to her more broadly, participant 12, the second of them, said essentially the senior pastor's goal was to employ her to do children's ministry and never have to think about it again. And you could easily do the same with women's ministry. You employ someone to do it so you can never think about it again. But what that communicates is that the senior pastor doesn't care. He feels compelled by something or other to do something, but it's not a ministry that he values. And that's entirely obvious to the person who's in it. So there's no partnership in that, right? You go and do it. He doesn't want to be a partner. It's a silo. We're looking for partnership, and he doesn't develop that partnership. How can you do partnership? Well, how do you show partnership if you're a senior pastor? The first quote then, doing practical things. You can't do it all the time, but the odd thing here and there shows concern. Words of encouragement, saying things that value the ministry publicly is good, giving it resources. But probably the most common thing the women said about how the senior pastor can value the ministry is by giving it his time to think about it. So there was no question about whether or not the women were verbal processors, but an oddly high number of them volunteered that they were verbal processors. And to have a meeting with the senior pastor where they could just talk through, I'm thinking this, what do you think of that, sharpen up the idea, they massively valued that. And it showed he valued the ministry. That was probably the main way that senior pastors showed that they cared about the ministry, just giving time to listen to her. Valuing the ministry translates pretty directly onto whether or not you value the person. Rightly or wrongly, that's the case, and therefore to that sense of partnership. So if we go back to our diagram, I hope you can see the link there between making a valuable contribution and partnership. Something substantial, something that is valued, leads inevitably, really, to some sort of sense of partnership. I'm going to give you 30 seconds to jot something down if you want to, or send in a question if you want to, and just to break up the points, because talking for an hour, I'll get bored. So do that. All right, that's your 30 seconds. Let's come back. Let's move to the next one over, which is having a voice and being heard, which I'm asking you not to do now. All right, having a voice and being heard. This is massively important. This came out as a huge theme. The interview relationships could be classified as positive, ambiguous, or negative, right? So one of those three. The diaries, I didn't have enough information to classify. But the other three, you were positive, you were ambiguous, or you were negative. In all five of the negative relationships, this was a problem, having a voice and being heard. And you can see there that it came up in virtually every participant. So it came up a lot. What are we talking about? Let's start with having a voice. When it comes to having a voice, there are two parts. The first part we might call cultural, and that's that there is an invitation to speak. Explicitly or implicitly, just through a culture of seeking opinions, encouraging discussion, encouraging even disagreement. So there's that kind of cultural bit. The second part is structural, and we're going to deal with that more in the second session later on. It is possible to structure your meetings in a way that excludes the voices of women, and that can be very problematic. Let's start with the first one, though, the cultural part. Here's our quotation. This is from a very positive relationship. The senior pastor said, in the end, I actually think the most significant thing that you offered was your input into our team. So having a female voice, a theologically trained female voice speaking into these situations and looking at things from a different perspective from the way the blokes might. He said that was of enormous value. I would definitely say that he was an encourager of people being heard, but but particularly having that female perspective, he thought was a really valuable, valuable thing. Well, that's someone you want to work with. It doesn't mean they always agreed, but that senior pastor is seeking out her opinion. A number of the participants comment really positively about the senior pastor's habit of seeking their opinion, about particular instances where they sought her opinion. It's often tied to respect and to trust. You ask people's opinion because you respect their opinion. That's why you want to know. You have some trust in their judgment, in their wisdom, that kind of thing. And so it's a vote of confidence to ask someone for their view, which is why it helps to build that relationship. A couple of other participants also commented favourably on a culture that had been established in staff meeting, finding a way to allow people to disagree in a staff meeting or just voice their concerns positively. That's seen as really good. Let me say briefly here, we'll come back to it, I think, in the next one, that yelling and being aggressive, which unfortunately came up more than once, that's not good. I'm going to say more about it later, but a culture of being yelled at just means that no one feels free to speak. And just to be clear, it doesn't matter who you're yelling at. If you have a habit of yelling, no one feels free to speak. You don't have to be yelling at the woman for it to create a culture where she can't speak. I'm also going to add something else here. It didn't come out in the study, which surprised me, so I probably shouldn't add it, but I've heard it enough times from women that I'm just going to anyway, because this is not my PhD, so I can ad lib. When there's only one woman on a medium-sized staff team or a large staff team, being the only female voice can be really hard work. Really hard work. To always be the one who sees things a little bit differently, or who has to remind the meeting of the existence of the other half of the congregation, makes you feel like you're being difficult, like you're the difficult one all the time. You're always in that role. Let me say to the women here, it's not you being difficult. That's your job, and you should keep doing it. And to the blokes, affirm that, like really encourage the women to keep doing that, value that they're the one who always has a different view. It's quite a burden for women to carry. The second part, as I said, it was structural. So women do massively value having individual meetings with the senior pastor. Having space to do that, that's important, and it just builds the relationships really positively. We're going to talk in the second session about the fact that staff teams can get too big and that needs a solution. So if that's what you're thinking, I can't meet with 20 staff, hold that thought. We'll come back to that in the next one. So people want to meet. Frequently cancelling that meeting, though, that's a dud. Or just not turning up, that's worse. So if you're frequently cancelled, there's just a lack of care expressed in that, and that devalues the person's role. The bigger structural problem comes up when there's large staff teams. So sometimes, if you've got a big staff team, there's just a need to create a second level, like a smaller meeting where you can get different things done. And so some of the ministry staff have to be excluded. And so we're going to look at this more in the next session, as I said, but I want to give you a sense of the issue, particularly for those not coming to the next one. Here's a quote. It's going to bring out the frustration when there's no opportunity to speak and be part of decision making. I think when we decided that I was leaving, it's worth noting this is how serious it is, like it was another kind of crisis point where things were just getting overwhelming. Decisions were being made I wasn't part of, but had massive implications for me. And I asked, so if you had to sum up why you left, I think a combination of just being worn out by so many changes of role and that mine kept growing kind of without limits. So if you just look at the paper, I was just given more and more and more and more, but with less communication and less access to where decisions were being made. So I didn't have a voice. And so I said, I feel like you don't want me on the team when I don't have a voice. Like I'm not in meetings, I'm not consulted, I'm just given more responsibility, but not actually given the respect that, like I'm not being treated as a senior member of staff when I'm not even in the room. Like I felt I was being given the closed door a lot longer before he was aware of it. He wasn't intending to, but the decisions, the implications of the decisions he was making were that I was just like more and more on the outer. Then me, did you want to go? Yes and no. So I didn't want to stay in a role where I didn't have a voice and where I couldn't do my job effectively. That wasn't a negative relationship. That was one that we would classify as an ambiguous relationship. So it did end in resignation, but the relationship itself was friendly and fairly positive. This was the issue. This is what took it from being positive to being ambiguous. It's not easy to solve, but when you're working out your meeting structures, these things are really important. And not having a voice kills partnership, and so it kills the relationship. When it comes to the other half of this, which is being heard, it's worth saying that having a voice isn't quite enough. People actually need to be heard. What does that mean? Let's hear from participant three. I know that my opinion is valued, but at the end of the day, he could disagree, and that's his prerogative. So I think a difference between Church A and Church B is even though Luke would ask my opinion, it was very rarely enacted. Whereas Brian, like sometimes about sermons and stuff, I'll give feedback or we'll be talking at staff meeting and it will make it into the sermon. And you're like, oh, you are listening. a few participants said something a little bit like that. So you'll see there, she absolutely recognises that listening doesn't mean agreement all the time, right? He can disagree, that's his prerogative. There's no expectation that the bloke's going to act on everything that she says. But if they're never acted on, then it does feel like you're not being heard. And even being acted on or agreeing, it doesn't have to be total. Just adopting part of an idea, having the senior pastor change his mind a little bit, all of that's an indication that you're being heard. If nothing is ever taken up, then it's very hard to feel like you've been heard. This was one of the few areas of the study where there were comments that were made that were gendered. So if you look at what we've already talked about, I think you'll find it's mostly true for a male associate as well, isn't it? No male associate wants to make an insignificant contribution and not be heard. And, you know, that's sort of the same for everyone. But being able to be heard was one of the areas where a couple of women felt like they weren't heard specifically because they were women. I'm going to give you the quote because it brings it out the best, I think. So the participants described a situation, they're implementing something new, and she's made a suggestion several times about this being the best way to do it. It took the guys 2 years to get to the same idea, and it was when, you know, one of the men suggested it that we suddenly started doing it, even though for 2 years I'd been going, no, what we need to do is da-da-da-da-da. Yeah, and that would often happen. I felt like that often happened to me in staff team. I'd speak, say something, it would get shut down, like to the point where some of the apprentices notice it. So one of the apprentices at the time, I just remember at one meeting him turning to me and going, shame they don't actually listen to you. It comes out a bit there, it comes out more in the wider context of the interview, that basically when a man says something, it gets listened to, when she speaks, it doesn't. That's hopeless. Right? That's just, you're not being heard. There's no point having a voice if you're not being heard, and there's no good reason. There's nothing complementarian about that. Here's the other one, and again, technically, this is outside the scope of the PhD, but I don't care. So this will carry the idea, and it'll just give you a sense of the frustration that this person felt. This year was the first time that I really felt like, wow, this sucks being a woman among these guys and having really to fight, not simply to have my voice heard, but to do the job I've been asked to do is hard work, and I'm feeling really beaten down by it and undermined and undervalued because I'm a woman. That's pretty clear, and it just ought not be, I think we'd want to say. It's not enough to have people in the room and to let them speak. We have to listen to it. There needs to be some indication that they're being listened to. Not total agreement all the time, but some indication that they're being listened to. If we bring that together, what does having a voice do? It makes people feel trusted, respected, and valued, and all of that contributes to that sense of partnership, and that's the making of a good relationship. I don't think that's rocket science, but it is massively important in terms of the relationship. So if we go back again to the diagram, partnership's the goal. You make a valuable contribution, that helps partnership. If you have a voice and you're heard, it helps partnership. And if those things aren't true, there's no sense of partnership and the relationship falls apart. All right, you can have another 30 seconds to jot something down about that or send in a question, and then we'll do the next bit. All right, that'll do us. Let's come to the third big one. Yeah, no, really. Let's come to the third big one. The third building block is the personal relationship itself. And again, there's a few sub-themes there. You can see in this table there are three elements here to the personal relationship. The first one's the personality fit, which is whether or not you click as people. And that's something actually that you can't do very much about. Then there's personal concern, and you can actually extend personal concern to anybody, and that has a lot more to do with actions than with personality. And then finally, the relationship beyond the workplace, which is the relationship particularly with the senior pastor's wife and kids, if he has a wife and kids. Let's look at them in turn. Personality fit, when it came to that in the interviews, it wasn't everything and it wasn't nothing. So there were positive relationships where participants had a good personality fit, right? You'd expect that. That's pretty obvious. Positive relationships, good fit. Excellent. There were also positive relationships, though, where that personality fit was difficult and they had to work at it. Some of them did some personality tests to help them to work each other out a little bit, but they still had a really good working relationship, even though they didn't personally click. There were also people who had a good personality fit and not a positive working relationship. So just clicking doesn't solve it. It also doesn't terminate it. But it's not nothing. It does help. It's a good step in the right direction. Having said that, in the five unambiguously negative relationships, right, so the five worst relationships, none of them described a good personality fit. Now, let me clarify that a little bit. The interview is very, very lightly structured. So once we've got past what church do you work at and what's your job, literally the only question was, what was your experience of working with Bob? That being the case, not everything came up in every interview. And so I didn't ask about personality fit, it just came out in most of the interviews. None of the five negative relationships gave the impression of a good personality fit, is what I'd say. And with some of them, it was directly said. So you don't want to overread that. It's also possibly the case that even people who click go off each other by the time that a working relationship's gone really bad. So it's a little bit hard to be sure. Don't overread that data. Far more important was personal concern. Concern for the person, not just for their ministry. So no one wants to just be a tool in someone else's toolkit, right? Concern actually for the person. Here's the way it manifested. This is just a few of them. Asking about the weekend, asking about mental health, Bible reading, pastoring us. Buying me coffee came up. It's funny, someone else mentioned buying me chocolate. Again, it's not going to fix it, but it communicates something. It does do something. Encouraging self-care, taking time to talk or listen, giving time off when ministry's been emotionally draining, giving time off for family crises, encouraging meeting with peers, encouraging conference attendance, paying for counselling after workplace stress. There's a million ways to show some kind of personal concern, and it makes a big difference when you do. One particular way that senior pastors show support, though, is having her back. That kept coming up. He had my back. He had my back. Again, no question, but in 9 of the interviews, this topic came up, having someone's back. Now, this is a little bit difficult because if I tell you the stories, they totally give away anonymity because these stories are all unique. So I can't give you that. But let me take you through what's common in a good response. What does it mean to have someone's back? So one of the participants said, there was no sense in which he made me feel like I was imagining things. Another one said, he was very good at agreeing that, no, I wasn't being treated nicely. And on the other hand, there was another senior pastor who kind of minimised the difficulty that someone was having. What's better is to acknowledge that there really is a problem, okay? assuming that there is, to acknowledge that it's a problem and that the way the person's feeling is legitimate. So that was the first part of having their back. The next part is the step to action. Here's our quote for this one, which summarises what came out as a good process. So, yeah. I appreciated having Simon kind of handle the situation. There have been other situations where someone's given me feedback about something and I've just handled it. But this was sort of because it was big. I think that's one of the things that made me feel valued and respected. That having made a decision, when there is pushback, he'll say, well, we decided on this as a team, or we decided that. You know, you and I decided that. So if people want to have an argument about it, send them to me. Don't feel like you have to handle it, but like, sure, go for it. And they're less likely to harangue the senior pastor than the children's worker. The first thing to note is the senior pastor handled the situation, right? He stepped in and he did something. But notice, though, it's not every time something goes wrong. All of the women that I interviewed were mature, godly, competent women who don't need the senior pastor to step in every time there's an issue. Every situation they described when they were doing this was a big kind of serious, often conflict sort of situation. The second thing is he backed the decision. In this instance, it was a decision that they'd made together, but in other instances, it was she's made a decision in her area of responsibility and he backs it. So he backs that decision. That was important. And the third thing to notice, it's not a third element, is that line at the bottom there, which somebody laughed at. They're less likely to harangue the senior pastor than the children's worker. I suspect most children's workers would agree with that. And I think most women's workers would as well. There's something about being the senior pastor that just gives you clout that associates don't have. And so it can make it easier for the senior pastor to step in. And then the last thing is handling the emotion. So this came up more than once. Here's a quote from participant six. If I was finding it hard or whatever, Will could deal with tears okay, which was good. I remember one time I had this phone call. I'd been basically berated by this woman on the phone for 10, 15 minutes. Will came in later going, are you okay? Like, what's happened? What do we need to do? Which was lovely. I felt that people had my back, which I'd never doubted that they did, but that was one particular situation where it was obvious that they did. And it wasn't like, oh dear, she's crying or whatever. There's really no need to be scared of a few tears. People can cry, it'll be okay. And so being able just to handle that. So if you bring all of that together, what are we talking about? Having someone's back, acknowledge the issue, take some action, so step in, back her decisions, and then just handle whatever emotion is in the room. And then finally, in terms of the personal relationship, there's the relationship outside of work. And this is an interesting area, I think. Accountants and retail workers don't expect to have a relationship with their boss's wife and kids. But our church context is different. So the senior pastor is brother, pastor, and boss at the same time, which is a really complicated relationship. The senior pastor's family is part of the same church family that the associates are working in. And so it's an odd context. What are the right expectations in that context? Happily, not the subject of my PhD. But someone else needs to think about that. I think we do need to set our expectations rightly around what that relationship should be. Let me tell you what did come out. Of the eight positive relationships, one of them made no mention of relationship with the senior pastor and his family, which doesn't mean anything, it just means it didn't come up. Six of them had a positive relationship. One of them had a negative relationship with the senior pastor's wife. Of the five unambiguously negative relationships, four of them were either negative or had no relationship with the senior pastor's family. Now, is that cause or effect? Do good relationships with the senior pastor's family flow from a positive working relationship, or does a positive working relationship come from a good relationship with the family? Probably a bit of both. But one thing that one of the participants said that was sort of helpful is, if the relationship's terrible, being invited around for dinner is not good. Like, it actually just feels awful. It's this kind of painful experience that she's desperately trying to get out of. So it's not a quick fix to just have someone around for dinner. There's a lot to dig into there. I don't know the answers on that. It's worth saying too, not all of the participants cared whether they had a social relationship or not with the senior pastor and his family. Some of them were happy just to be colleagues. They preferred it that way. One of the diary participants thought a bit more social interaction would help the relationship, but she says what she's talking about is dinner once a year, right? So she's not looking for a whole lot of relationship. So this is a thing. What kind of thing is it? I hope somebody will take up a bit of research into that. All right, so there are our three big building blocks, if we have the diagram. And I trust you can see that all three of them are feeding our goal, which is partnership working together. Okay. Nah, you can't have your 30 seconds. We're going to push on and cover the bottom one. The senior pastor character and skills. We're going to do this much more briefly. You can see on the diagram there are lines that go from ministry skills, strategy and organisation, structure and roles to each of those three big building blocks that we've just talked about. Those lines are links made by the women themselves. So that's not my observation. The women made those links. And so, for example, that he was able to communicate helped me to feel like what I was doing was valuable, right? That's a line between those two. The way he struggled to organise structures meant that I never knew what my role was, and so I didn't feel like I was doing anything valuable. Sometimes the link's really direct, sometimes it's really indirect. But the senior pastor's skills foster a workplace culture, and that indirectly as well fosters the relationship that the associate has. So let me run through them quickly. They won't all be equal. Strategy and organisation is one of the important ones. That's about setting a direction and organising the team's efforts around it. Okay, that's all we're talking about. One of the participants explaining something positive in the senior pastor was that he fostered a team environment where we all know where we're going and what's expected. Another one, talking about a new position, what she was looking for was just the confidence that you know where you want it to go and roughly how it's going to get there and how I slot in. They're not looking for anything fancy, right? This is kind of what we're doing and this is sort of your role in it. That's all they're looking for. But without that, it's really hard for them to know what the job is and to make that substantial contribution. They just need to know that there's a plan. The same participant said this about her previous job. One of the reasons that I left wasn't because Luke was a bad boss per se, it was just kind of the lack of vision. I don't really know what I'm adding or doing, and it just feels like stopgap measures based on my skill set rather than this is where the ship is going and how you can be on board. You can see how that's the opposite, I hope. She doesn't know where things are going, she doesn't know how she fits in, and the result is she's not contributing anything, it's ineffective, so it's not really working. She can't make a valuable contribution. She can't express partnership in the ministry because she doesn't know what it is that their partner's in doing. And so you'll see there that the senior pastor's skills at this point, it's not his intention, but his skills in putting together some sort of goal and communicating it are contributing to whether or not this partnership can work. Participant 12 worked in a situation as well where the senior pastor did know where he wanted to go, but he couldn't organise around it. Once you start having people under you, you've got to be so much more organised and planned, and you can't do last minute. And he's very spontaneous and can pull something off at the last minute and can change his opinion and mind and track like that. But you've got all these other people underneath you structurally. So he went from working by himself to leading a 5-6-person team, like very different skill sets. He loves the big idea, he hates the detail. Like it's a completely different skill set, leading a team of people to just doing a one-man church. And so your organisational skills and your planning and your detail have to be so much better. That's a really clear and helpful quote, I think. So here's a guy who in one ministry situation, it works, right? But once you give him a team, if he's not clearer in his organisation about what we're doing, no one under him knows what's happening. And suddenly it doesn't work anymore. There's also a link between organisation and communication, and it's, sometimes it's a little bit hard to divide that link. Let me give you another quote. "I'm feeling like I've just got to put my head down and try and get on with what I've got to do, but then also feeling like, because we're not meeting and communicating, the goalposts keep changing. He was really good at kind of going, let's try something new. Oh, this option's come up and let's go with it, which I'm like, that's great, but you weren't communicating that with me. So he would have said, we're doing something. I do a whole heap of work towards that, and then the goalposts would get changed because he decided to do something different. And I was finding it hard not to be frustrated at that. I've spent hours working towards the one thing and then it's been changed to something else." If that happens once, we can all live with it, right? It happens. But if that happens a lot, that is really frustrating and very hard to work under in the long term. And I hope you can see there as well that her ability to make a contribution in partnership is what's thwarted, because she doesn't know where they're going anymore. And so she's working on one thing, but it turns out that it's not the thing that the team's working on, except no one's told her that that's the case. And so organisational skills, setting direction, a bit of strategy, all of that is important in facilitating partnership. The next one over on the diagram is establishing structures and defining roles. And the key thing here is people need to know what their roles are. And it taps into being able to make a contribution. Three things to avoid. The first is overlapping roles, where it's hard to know who's responsible. That can lead to conflict, right? You've got overlapping roles. Someone thinks they should be involved and they get excluded, or someone's given a job and they don't think it's their role and suddenly it's landed on their desk. So you need really roles that don't overlap. The second one to avoid is too much freedom. Let me give you a quote from participant 11. "I don't think I was ever asked to do anything in particular." And some people would say, oh, it's great, you can do what you want. And I'm thinking, no, it's not, because I think that an important part of this is a vision for our church. This is the way that I think it would be really helpful for you to serve. Can you please do this? Just do something is not a job description. And too much freedom just doesn't, that's her frustration there. We talked a little bit before the interview. She said something about expectations, and I thought the problem was there were all these expectations she hadn't been told. In fact, it turned out there were no expectations of her of any kind. She was just employed to, well, yeah, whatever, right? And so you need to have some sort of instruction. She had literally no idea what she was expected to do. And then the third thing to avoid is the one that I thought it was going to be, which is the mystery job description. So again, participant 12, "I was asked, do you have clear boundaries? I go, whenever I ask for boundaries or what's my expectations, he's very vague. Just do the children's ministry. But as soon as I stepped outside what his reality was, I knew about it. So he said, I don't have any expectations, but he did. But you didn't know about them till you'd stepped out of it." Right? Again, that's a terrible way to have to live. You end up walking on eggshells because you don't know what the expectations are. And so defining roles, again, contributes to just being able to make a contribution. If you don't know where you fit, you can't make a contribution. It also links to being heard, and we're going to do more of that, as I said, in the next section. The next one over is communication. That's just kind of an obvious necessary skill. All the things that we've looked at require some communication skills. Strategy, being organised, defining a role, having clear structures, all of that needs to be communicated. And it's pretty hard to work in partnership if you don't know what's going on. I'll just give you one quick quote here from one of the diaries. "I don't feel like I know what's going on, what to expect, or how to be helpful. I feel like I'm on my own." There's no good partnership comes out of feeling like that. The next one over is conflict management. Conflict in a team is probably inevitable, but how it's managed determines whether it's constructive or problematic. Two positive approaches. One, a proactive approach when conflict does happen. Don't ignore it, step into it, try and solve it. But the other is a preventative approach of building trust and fostering a way to disagree before it becomes kind of catastrophic conflict. The negative conflict avoidance came out, so a constructive approach is better. And I mentioned before, raised voices is no good. I want to read you a quote now from one of the women about raised voices so that you can get a sense of what it's like for one of these women. "I definitely didn't feel safe on the staff team. I asked, can you unpack that for me? So over the years, Dave has changed and mellowed, but definitely if he ever felt threatened or didn't understand what people thought about him, he would be quite vocal and aggressive in what he would say. Me, so his tone's aggressive? Yeah, it's changed over the years, but definitely, like raised voice and in staff meeting, especially on a particular issue or something like that, or if someone pushed back on him. Me, so he's hard to disagree with? Definitely. And if you do disagree with him, you move on pretty quickly. But often in staff meetings, there was raised voices between the other men. I think towards the end of my time, I would not go into a meeting alone with Dave. I always wanted someone with me. Me, wow, why was that? Not because I felt as though he didn't hear or listen to anything I said, so I needed someone." Now, I need to be careful the way I interpret that last bit, but it looks to me like she backs away a little bit in that last sentence from what she was thinking. I think she felt unsafe. I don't think she thought he was actually going to hit her or anything like that, but blokes yelling at women will make most women feel physically vulnerable. And I think she probably didn't feel physically safe. Not because he was yelling at her, but yelling in general, I think, makes most women feel physically vulnerable. So it just shouldn't be part of the way staff relate in a church. Next one over, relational skills. I don't want to spend too much time here, but if you're going to run a team, you need some relational skills and some emotional intelligence, actually. That came out several times. Some understanding of team dynamics. Ministry skills and character. We've mostly here looked at skills to run a team. Ministry skills are the other things that you need in ministry, your ability to preach, your pastoral skills. Often in the context of a good relationship, the women spoke highly of him as a pastor, as a preacher, that kind of thing. They're confident that the congregation's in good hands, and that makes for a good, positive relationship. When it comes to character, again, positive character builds trust, negative character undermines it. So here is a table of the things the women mentioned. I'll let you scan the table. But remember, there's no question about this. I assume there were more pastors that were prayerful than just number five, right? But I this is the one that volunteered a comment. There was no question about it. It's worth saying there that there aren't a lot of negative comments, but where there were, it wasn't a small thing. It was significantly damaging to the relationship. So character there matters. All right, let me make a few concluding comments and then we'll go to questions. When it comes to the senior pastor's skills, the women were really clear that they don't expect the blokes to be perfect. One of them said, "I don't need another Jesus, he's come," right? That's right. We're not talking about high-level skills. Just in some cases, just admitting that that's not your strength and asking someone else to do it is enough to get it done. But there is a skill set that the senior pastor needs. And it's a different skill set to being a sole pastor or probably even just a pastor with one other person. There is a skill set that's required to be a senior pastor. It's not perfection, but it does exist. And I hope, although I've just hurled a lot of information at you, that it gives you a little bit of confidence. I hope there's nothing there that surprised you. None of that seems very bizarre to me to have turned up in what makes a good relationship. There is no secret sauce to making these relationships work. It's exactly what you think it would be. None of the women I interviewed were fragile and oversensitive, right? They were competent, godly, matter-of-fact kind of women. There's not much in the results that's highly gendered. Most of what I've said would be true for male associates as well. And so there's really no reason that these relationships shouldn't work. Like, we shouldn't be put off mixed gender teams. I think there's nothing in this that we can't do. Let me come back and say, hopefully you can see from that just how much this study is what the women see in this relationship and how much we need someone to do the other side. So seriously, if someone wants to talk to me about that, I'd really like to chat with you. In almost every instance where the relationship went wrong, the woman being interviewed said something like, "He should be in ministry. He's a good guy. He just shouldn't be a senior pastor." There are gifts and skills you need as a senior pastor that you don't need to have if you're an associate or if you're working solo. And if you don't have them, that's okay. Don't be a senior pastor. Like, that's not a character flaw, and it's not an issue of godliness. For all of us, I think we need to be careful as we train people for ministry that we don't assume that everyone's heading for the same kind of ministry. And we need to make it easy for people who have a go at being senior pastors to say, "Oh, that's not my thing," and to move to something else. We need culturally not to see that as a catastrophic failure or as a character flaw or a problem. You have a go the first time, discover it's not for you, that's okay. There's lots of ministry for us to do. But I want to say too that on the whole, there were lots of women who really appreciated their senior pastors. They worked well with them. They found joy in that relationship. They found partnership in the gospel. There was more women like that in the study than there were ones who had issues. All right, how about we take questions?